It's been a heck of a year. My mom fell and broke her shoulder at some point, ended up in the hospital in March. In our effort to get her out of the COVID danger zone, we brought her home, and I was trying to care for her by myself, and started getting exhausted after about 10 days, brought my brother in. He came in to help out really graciously, and turns out my mom came home with COVID, gave it to me, gave it to my brother. My brother and my mother both ended up in the hospital. I ended up on my couch for 10 straight days of no eating, 101 and a half fever. About day six, I started thinking, what's my will look like? Should I refresh my will? And then day seven, I'm starting to think about writing letters to all my four kids. Incredibly humbling experience. And so for any of you who've had COVID already, I know what that's like. I know. And it's funny, the thing that really got me through, at some point, after I thought, should I write letters to my kids? I thought, no, I'm going to fight. What can I do to fight? And years and years of program have taught me that service is how you fight your disease. How you fight negative thoughts to take you down is you find somebody to help. So the first thing I thought is, once I recover, I'm going to give plasma. I'm going to give plasma and hopefully save some other people. Then I started, for whatever reason, COVID has these weird kind of fever dreams that go on for days. And they also, you just get fixated on thoughts for 3-4 days at a time. And I started thinking, I'm going to learn how to cook barbecue and I'm going to feed people. And so those are my sustaining thoughts. And the other thing I thought too is, it forced me to look at my relationships with everybody, my children, my wife, everybody, and really, really start to look at where am I still deficient? I've been in recovery. I'm a kind of a four-time winner here. I started back in 1987 in NA, switched to AA, started going to Al-Anon right away, started going to ACOA. And so I've been around these programs for a while, and my entire life has essentially unfolded from my participation in these programs. I was 23 when I sobered up and started working on recovery. And I can honestly say that 33 years later, this has been my best year of Al-Anon recovery. I have done more work on myself, more work on myself in relationship to other people, and more work on boundaries, on kind of really getting to the heart of the issue of not really feeling loved, not being able to let any of that in. I'm just very humbled, because as soon as I started to go down this path and really work Al-Anon really, really hard, all kinds of things have happened. I got to speak at Lois's Picnic where Mimi reached out. She introduced me to Keith, and I've had a number of great conversations with him. I can't wait to come out next year and meet you all in person. I'm definitely a convert at this point. The just doing the gratitude meeting the other day where the depth of recovery was just immense. It's just a deep pool you're all swimming in, and I want to come swim too. So I can tell you that there's a couple really interesting things about my story that are definitely worth sharing with larger groups. Some of them have something to do with me. Some of them are my hard work in recovery over 33 years, coming up on 34 in April. And some of them just are because of the family I was born into. So just before I get into that, I just wanted to reiterate a couple of the traditions, just because I think they're worth underlining at this point in life, in this point in the world. Number one, tradition one and tradition 10, unity and avoiding public controversy. This is the one spot I can count on where I can come and just be a person and just meet you all on the level as other individuals looking to recover from the effects of alcoholism in your life. And so to me, that's critical. So you'll hear nothing from me other than, you know, I'm really happy to be here and this is a wonderful fellowship. And then Tradition 12, you'll understand why I'm highlighting Tradition 12 in a second, because I'm in a strange place as an individual in recovery, because I guess you could say that many of us have very dysfunctional families, but mine is kind of a historically dysfunctional family. We have more dysfunction in our family over tons of generations, but it's pertinent here specifically because I have a very unique perspective on the progression of recovery in a family, in an extended family. So I just appreciate all your assistance in keeping my anonymity, because you'll all be able to guess at who I am pretty easily. And so it's always tricky speaking in front of people about this. So my grandfather's brother was a guy named Ebby T. And I always got to pause a little bit for Ebby. Ebby's been deceased a bunch of years, since 1966. And Ebby's part of the reason we're all sitting here today. Ebby is the one who sobered up Bill Wilson. And Bill considered him his sponsor for the rest of his life. And to me, Ebby was he was an important link in the chain that has us able to meet virtually with people from all over the world right now. And the thing that's so remarkable to me is that I'm a link in the chain for some people. And all of you are a link in the chain for some people. So the role Ebby played is no more important than the role Mimi played. It's no more important than the role I play. It's no more important than the role that any of you play in your own lives. And the really interesting thing about our family is, like, we just did a quick kind of like, we looked through just first cousins, uncles, aunts, and so forth to see how many recovering people there are in our family now. And we've got, we've basically got 23 people in our immediate family who are in recovery. And our family has been participating in recovery for about 86 years now. So even a little bit before the official birth of AA, because the official birth of AA is when Dr. Bob stopped drinking and started working with Bill. So if anything, you know, Al-Anon's date predates AA's, because we were working on our issues a year before and struggling with an alcoholic and a couple alcoholics. And
I would like
So basically the interesting thing here is that we did a count of clean years, of sober years, for our extended family. And we have, just at a family gathering, we have 414 years of recovery. It's a very unusual place for a family to be in. There's three generations of recovery. And it's interesting because I can tell you straight up, I still need the program badly. We still need the program badly as a family, and I still need the program badly as an individual. We have taken the alcohol out of big chunks of our family system, but all the isms are still there, and all the ick is still there, and we have to work. I mean, there's a lot of us who still go to meetings. There's a lot of us at any given moment, you might find six or seven of us in the same meeting, which is pretty rare and wonderful. But there are, I think we've got 10 people over 20 years of recovery in our family right now. We've had six die while in recovery. My cousin Steve, thinking of Steve a lot this year. He died, I believe he had 22 years of recovery when he died this year. And he died too early of COVID. And tough loss. My mom has survived. She's been in recovery over 45 years, in Al-Anon recovery over 45 years. My brother hospitalized as well. He's been in recovery for a while too. He's got up 20 plus years now. And it's just such a privilege to be in this family, because we're able to see how recovery is needed even when you're not drinking as a family. Oop, did I freeze? Okay. We've been able to see kind of how necessary recovery is. I've come to believe that recovery is necessary for anybody who ever didn't learn the thing they could have learned earlier in life. You know, we all suffer from mistakes we make. We all suffer from mistakes our parents made. We all suffer from things that happened to us. Just, you know, I blew out a knee when I was 16, and I wasn't very resilient, and I thought I was going to be a professional athlete, and as many 16-year-old boys do. And I didn't have any backup plan. And, you know, that's really all it took for me to start drinking. I started smoking cigarettes first and then started drinking. And then by the time I got to college, I was ready for the races. So the progression of recovery in a family is a real thing. And I can tell you that my kids, the kids of most of my cousins and aunts and uncles and everybody, there's not a ton of alcohol abuse. There's workaholism, there's codependence, there's all the things we come to Al-Anon for. Every one of them, just because they're related to me in some way, is qualified to be sitting in this meeting with us here today. And some of them will find that recovery for different reasons. It's amazing just to watch the children, the kids we have and the kids who've watched us all recover. They don't reach for alcohol as a go-to strategy. They might reach for emotionalism. They might reach for distance. They might reach for like lots of different things that I did as a parent, mistakes I made as a parent. But they don't run to the drugs and alcohol the way I did. I mean, at 16, one bad thing happened and I was right to the drugs and alcohol. And I didn't get sober for the next 7 years. I ran hard. But yeah, it's just interesting to see that what we're doing today, the link in the chain that we are for our family, it's going to play out. And it's going to play out year after year. And the longer you stay in recovery, like somebody asked me the other day, you know, one of my favorite employees has got a just came up on her first year of recovery, and we've been talking all along, and it's just wonderful to see. And you know, she asked me what's the thing I've learned most in recovery, and what do I value most? And I said, you know, I really value waking up with the same thoughts, feelings, and ideas that I went to bed with. And they're not all good thoughts and feelings. They're not all feelings I'm committed to holding on to. They're not even thoughts that are rational or whatever, but they're the same as yesterday. And I'm working through them, and I'm working through the feelings and emotions, and I don't react the same way I used to. I have a lot more perspective now, because day after day, month after month, year after year, those thoughts and feelings have piled up, and I've been able to start to discard the ones and or quickly dismiss the ones that I know are nonsense, that lead me down paths that I don't want to go down. And it's funny, it's been, you know, I just want to say just a shout out to Zoom. Zoom has been the recovering folks' greatest friend in this year. I think we've all learned stuff. We've expanded our recoveries in ways that would not have been possible without Zoom and Teams and Facebook chat and everything else. It's not the same as being in your presence and kind of glorying in that and getting hugs and really getting the sense of the depth of your purpose in person. But it's allowed for other things. I have a really good friend from college who, Janet might even be on this call. She's gone through a first year in recovery, and she and I have been able to connect and stay in touch and even go to some meetings together. And she lives a long way from me. I'm sitting in upstate New York right now, and she's in Utah. And, you know, maybe we catch a meeting if I go visit or something like that, but it wouldn't be the kind of thing where we could talk once a week and I could get to watch her struggle with things that would have brought me to my knees in the first year. And for me, it's really helped a lot because a lot of the work she's done has been Al-Anon work, and watching her gives me a lot of courage. And it relights the fire under me. You know, working with people with less time, it's been highly motivating. I've learned so much this year. A lot of what I've learned, well, let's talk a little bit about kind of where I came from and why I'm just another recovering Al-Anon person here, you know? Growing up, dad was a hard drinker, 2 6-pack-a-night drinker. My mom was a flaming codependent. And our whole emotional system, I was the oldest of 3 children, and my job was to protect my own other two. There was a lot of fighting. There was a lot of upset. There was a lot of emotional needs not getting met. Some of those fell to me as a young kid. My dad was also a workaholic. You know, just he was working or he was drinking. It was really kind of pick your poison. And I modeled the workaholism, and I took off with that. By the time I was like 6 or 7, I was mowing lawns and shoveling driveways, and I always had 40 or 50 bucks in my pocket. And I worked 40 hours a week or more all the way through end of grade school, all of middle school, and all of it. And really what it is the system, the codependent system I lived in, bartered everything for everything. So if you were to get any love, you had to give up something. You had to give up some autonomy. You had to give up some freedom. You had to give up some physical affection. There was all kinds of bartering. It was just, I was taught that love was something you had to work for, and you had to give something else to other people to get. I given where I grew up to, it's, you know, I look back now and I'm really clear that I really didn't think anybody would ever love me. I just didn't think that was possible. It's not, you know, it's funny because you talk to somebody who's not in Al-Anon, who's not in recovery, and they have a lot of trouble getting that. It wasn't even a conversation. It wasn't even like a possibility for me. It was just something, you know, it's like, I'm not going to grow a full head of hair anytime soon. It's like, I don't spend a lot of time dwelling on that. I didn't ever spend a lot of time dwelling on, would anybody ever love me? It was just like, oh no, nobody will love you unless you're doing something for them, unless you're providing something to them, unless you're giving them something. Then, and that's where I grew up. And I grew up also not really feeling like I had any voice. So I didn't really believe that anything I said made any difference to anybody, because nobody really loved me in the first place. This year, the last 2 years especially, my program has been entirely focused in those areas. And it's been remarkable, the progress I've made. And some of it was just realizing that was the movie screen on which my movie was playing. You know, that there was a screen back there called, hey, I don't think anybody's ever going to love me. And it persisted, you know, 30 plus years into recovery. You know, I really didn't really believe in it. And it's funny because you look at my career choice. I'm an attorney. I manage really, really big groups of attorneys doing big e-discovery. So I'm currently managing the opiates case, the MDL for the opiates, along with all the associated cases. I've had upwards of 550 attorneys working for me, you know, and it's great for me because I get to stay off the limelight. I'm not in the limelight at all. And I get to serve and provide. And it's probably the case of my life. It's the most important thing going on for me in the U.S. today. And we're making a huge difference. These cases are coming out great. And it's going to make a big difference in the access to treatment for people. And the number of my friends who die this year because they left that church basement on Saturday and went for shoulder surgery the next Tuesday, and I never saw them again. You know, so for me, it's no coincidence that I had to work that hard, because, you know, it's the only way it's the only access I had to be loved. And now that I've realized, it's really funny, now that I've realized that it's just not true. It's just not true that I am lovable, that people do love me, and they count on me for just me, to be me, nothing else. I don't need to do anything to deserve it. And since I've learned that, I've been looking at all parts of my life, my work especially, at how can I, my whole work was set up on me being a hero and working 80 or 90 hours a week. And how what I've had to do this year mainly is give up the stuff that made me so successful in the first place. Working too much, dedicating myself, singularly focusing when nobody else could. I've given up my success strategies for the sake of having a life outside of work. Timing couldn't be better. My wife and I are finally empty nesters. All our kids have either launched or are in the process of launching. They've all gotten out of college. We're left wondering, who are we? And we got together when I was 25. I was a baby in recovery, and I knew nothing. And I had no business being in relationships because I had no model of a good relationship. I had no idea back then what a good relationship looked like. And so here we are all these years later, and it's like, okay, we got to talk about boundaries. What's a boundary? I don't know. We got to figure some out, though, because it's not working. It's not working for her. It's not working for me. And for the two of us to work together, and she's in recovery too. She's been in recovery for a long time. We met in recovery a couple of years in. So we've had a chance. We've hung together, and we've raised kids, and we've done pretty well for ourselves. And at the same time, it's clear to both of us that we need to grow or go. We don't have the luxury of just focusing on all the busyness of the kids or the busyness of work and trying to pay for it all. Now we're left in a place where we can actually focus on ourselves and focus on becoming stronger and better. And one thing I'll tell everybody, just the ability to set a boundary, not out of anything but love for myself and love for the other person. It was very strange and awkward for a while, and it's getting much easier. The more I do it, the easier it is. I think the heart of it is understanding why I have a boundary, and what that provides for everybody. And once I understand it and can explain it, it's like, oh yeah, that makes a lot of sense. It makes a lot of sense that, you know, I need some time in my workshop because I'm a little pissy about work this week. You know, I need to go to my workshop and work on a little project and just cool down. You know, it's not that I'm angry at you in any way, shape, or form. I just need a little space. I need a little healing time for myself so that I can come back in and be a good husband, a good partner. You know, it's little things like that that I just had no clue about that, you know, this program, I wouldn't have anything. My whole life has come out of this program. I'm just so grateful, and I'm so humbled to be able to share some of the growth and the progress. I know I'm a little scattered, but it's a lot of it's coming from, there's so much growth this year. There's so much, it's so accelerated. It's a challenge to thinking that I was done. I kind of thought I had learned what I had to learn about recovery, and nothing could have been further from the truth. And I'm really excited to see what comes out of it. Because I've got a lot of time left. I've got a nice smoker now. I'm cooking barbecue and learning my craft, and I'm looking to feed people. So that's going to be a whole separate thing. And I've got some things I want to do in the world that I haven't done yet. And so I've got time, and I've got the inclination, and I've got enough self-respect and love for myself now because of basically you all showed me how. You know, without you all, I wouldn't know any of this stuff. You know, it would have been good enough to just rest on my successes. But I tell you, it's worth it to, you know, I was kind of like that, the monkey with the hand in the bottle around the banana. I just couldn't let go of the successes. And I couldn't let go of how I thought it had to be done. And I kept coming around and people said, keep coming back. And I did. And it's been a remarkable, remarkable journey. I can tell you that working with a sponsee, working with a sponsor, I'm still not that great at it after all these years, but I do it to some degree. And, you know, I could be better at it. I could be perfect at it, but I'm not. And you know what? It still works. The program works. There's a lot of leeway in this program for doing it as imperfectly as we all do it. I want to just really acknowledge all of the people in the program, who are here in this meeting. I especially want to acknowledge the past chairs. You're all a link in the chain. And I know already in this conference, I've had two or three moments. You know, did the meditation with Linda this morning. Great, great meditation. It's the first time I've done a long meditation. I actually meditate a lot. I'm probably good for 200 to 300 meditations a year. And I tend to meditate in the 15 to half hour range most of the time. Today's meditation, it ended after an hour and I did another half hour afterwards. So I did an hour and a half meditation. I came out of it very, very refreshed. So it was very, I think Linda said something like, the only way to meditate badly is to not do it at all. And I also want to acknowledge, so there's a number of moments in every one of these conventions where I think to myself, I just got my whole life out of that. That was worth a $10,000 consult to figure that little piece of my life out. You know, that's going to have a ripple effect. That's incredible. And the gratitude meeting yesterday is the same way. There was just some stuff said in there that it got me thinking entirely differently about my own life and how I'm living it and how I'm approaching my recovery. So I'm just really appreciative. I also just want to credit my higher power. I actually refer to my higher power as HP. When I came in, I've always had a lot of trouble with organized religion. And I needed a really personal connection to my higher power. So I've just referred to my higher power as HP all these years. And it works for me. And I have probably, you know, if you're looking at my spiritual program, I'm probably leaning Buddhist with a little Christianity left over in there as well. But I'm kind of like a Ten Commandments Christian. I can leave all the rest of it. I'll just take the good advice. Love your neighbor, you know, love each other like yourself. I can do that stuff. I can't get too deep into the philosophy or I start getting lost in people's ideas. And that's my problem. That's why I'm in Al-Anon. You know, I easily get lost in other people's thoughts and opinions and views of how I should be thinking about things and how I should be living my life. So I think I'm pretty close to time here. Mimi or Keith, do you have any idea?
You only have 2 hours left.
All right, let's start back at square one then. I was born. I was born in Solon, Ohio. No. I really appreciate everybody here. The way you live your life allows me to have a life. And your willingness to share it with me allows me to have a life. So thank you all very much. And you should all feel free to reach out to me. I'm always up for chatting and whatever else, as you can tell. Thank you.